Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf, recording in my home office with some potential special guest appearances from potentially my cat chicken or maybe the wild parrots next door. We'll see. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about their fave genre film, perhaps one that has influenced their own work in some small way. Today, I'm very excited to have actor Celeste O'Connor here with me. Hi, Celeste. How are you doing?
Hello. I am doing well. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Are you over in the East Coast right now?
Yes. Yeah. I am in Baltimore right now, my hometown.
There's a reason also why you're in Baltimore on the East Coast, too, which we'll get into in the bio of why you are over there. But please let me introduce Celeste to our listeners. Celeste was born in Nairobi, Kenya, and raised in Baltimore, where she got bit by the acting bug. Her first professional film role came in 2018 with Stephanie Lang's Netflix romantic dramedy Irreplaceable You, where she played the teenage version of Gugu Mbatha-Raw's character Abby. Then, 2019 proved to be a pretty big year for Celeste with a couple of indies that made waves. First was the drama Wetlands, where she shared the screen with Adewale Akinyoye Agbaje, Jennifer Ayle, and Anthony Mackie, telling the story of a man desperately trying to start over in Atlantic City. Then there was Tyree Chapeau's indie sleeper hit Stella in the Spades, where Celeste plays the new girl at a boarding school attempting to maintain a tumultuous friendship with a troubled queen bee. Listeners may remember Tyree's episode where she talks about Rian Johnson's Brick, so you can always go back and listen to that. The film also stars Lovie Simone, Jarrell Jerome, and Jesse Williams, and premiered at Sundance before Amazon picked it up for release this year. And lest you thought Celeste was only in the mood for drama, she now stars in the horror comedy Freaky, directed by Christopher Landon, which also stars Vince Vaughn as a psycho killer who body swaps with a teen girl played by Catherine Newton. Next, you'll be able to see Celeste in Jason Reitman's Ghostbusters Afterlife, a film I will not believe exists until it gets a release date. As a Ghostbusters Afterlife truther, however, I am very sure that Celeste will set me straight at some point in time in the interview. Like, you can't just keep this, you know, ruse going on for that long. And amid all of Celeste's film work, she is also a senior at Johns Hopkins University, majoring in global public health and pre-medicine. So that's another reason why you are back in Baltimore. She recently started a photography and styling business called Pedestal and is studying Arabic, playing violin, and singing to pass all that extra free time that you might have. I don't know what the...
Zero. Absolutely zero.
Oh, yeah. You know, you stay ready. So, Celeste, the movie that you chose to talk about today is Sorry to Bother You. Can you give us a little explanation on why this one became one of your fave genre films?
Yeah, Sorry to Bother You is one of my favorite movies. I think the first time I saw it, it was like, I didn't realize that movies could talk about like capitalism and politics in this way that was like blends like fantasy and magic, but also these like concepts that are very like real and intense for a lot of people, and there are things that I have been like organizing around and talking about in my like activist circles and my like academic circles. And so when I saw it in a movie, I was like, wow, this is amazing. So I think that was like really, really the first movie that I saw where I was like, this movie is talking about something that I'm really passionate about in a way that like I think is like actually really accurate.
And, you know, Boots Riley, who directed and wrote this film, also was one of very few contemporary filmmakers who has been able to make a movie about unions and labor, because we have fallen off on that in Hollywood for some reason. Yes. For those of you who have not seen Sorry to Bother You, today's episode will give you some spoilers. However, that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. My motto, as always, is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch Sorry to Bother You first, this is your shot. Now that you're back, let me introduce Sorry to Bother You. Written and directed by Boots Riley for release in 2018, Sorry to Bother You stars Lakeith Stanfield as Cassius, aka Cash, a broke dude trying to get ahead in Oakland. One day, he gets a job as a telemarketer at Regal View, where he meets Langston, played by Danny Glover. Langston teaches Cassius to use his white voice on the phone.
It's not really a white voice. It's what they wish they sounded like. So it's like what they think they're supposed to sound like. Yeah. Like this young blood.
Hey, Mr. Kramer. This is Langston from Regal View. I didn't catch you at the wrong time, did I?
Which immediately gives him access to his target's wallets. Cassius's artist girlfriend, Detroit, played by Tessa Thompson, gets a job at Regal View too. It's, you know, like, might be the best place so they can get some work. But then their new buddy Sal starts organizing them to form a union.
A 20-minute work stoppage during prime calling time. I'll give the call. Sal, what's the call?
Fuck you, pay me.
The other one.
Phones down.
Phones down. Okay? We hang up the phones, put down our headsets. Now they're gonna single some of us out. Threaten our jobs.
Fuck that!
Yes. Fuck that.
So at first, Cash ranks up with the union, even attends a protest. But then, the higher-ups at Regal View invite him into their golden elevator, a literal golden elevator, to tell him he's been promoted to an elite power caller.
They think you're A1 material. You're going upstairs, my compadre. Yes, you are getting a promotion.
Oh, also, their real money thing is selling arms and slave labor for the corporation Worry Free.
Worry Free is our biggest client. We help thousands of companies utilize Worry Free workers to improve their efficiency.
So wait, are you telling me you sell slave labor to companies over the phone?
Hot damn it. You are a sharp one.
Whose ads feature happy, smiling people sleeping in barracks, giving up all their worldly possessions for a simpler life.
Sign a worry-free contract. You're guaranteed employment and housing for life. Stop worrying and get worry-free.
Here's the thing. Cash is too tempted by the money not to take it. Sure, he's able to get a new apartment and a car, but Detroit just doesn't respect him anymore.
I'm so tired of talking to you about this. You are crossing the picket line. I can't ride with you.
Oh, you can't ride with me now. But you was riding with me all around.
All right, fine. Well, no more.
One day, Cash crosses the picket line and a protester hits him with a can of Coke and makes him a hugely popular internet meme and also a Halloween costume. Cash goes to Worry-Free CEO Lyft's party, where, as the only black person present, he is goaded into rapping for the guests in an extremely uncomfortable moment.
My name is Cash. I like to smash. I come from the land of dope. Somebody got something to smoke?
Then he snorts cocaine with Lyft and stumbles his way into what he thinks is a bathroom, but is actually like a locker room stable full of horse people who've snorted a powdery substance that turns them into ultra-strong horse people workers. So here's where things really start going wild. Lyft wants Cash to willingly turn into a horse person to control the other workers from the inside.
Two things. One, it's a short-term contract. 5 years, done. Then we give you the diffuser antidote special sauce serum, and you're back to normal. And the second one, and I want you to remember this, you're gonna have a horse cock.
But he's like, fuck no. Cash's dropped cell phone is used then by the horse people to send a video to Detroit. And Cash then tries to make all the media rounds to spread the word of what Worry Free is actually doing.
All right, call your local politicians and let them know we will not stand for this.
It's been one day since a viral celebrity leaked to the world new scientific achievements made by Worry Free and their genius CEO, Steve Lyft.
Unfortunately, nobody gives a shit. Cash wakes up one day and realizes that powder he snorted is actually now turning him into a horse. But, you know, turn lemons into lemonade. He then leads the horse people into a riot to storm Worry Free, and that's where we leave off. So, again, it's not what happens, but how it happens.
Wow. Hearing that synopsis laid out like that... So funny. It's like, this movie is insane and I'm obsessed.
I am curious about the way that Boots Riley puts these huge ideas that you're talking about earlier, right? So we've got labor, we've got human rights, we've got social justice, all these kind of like big blanket ideas that he's putting into there. And he's not really afraid or shy of putting them in there. But what he's doing is he's kind of couching them in humor and couching them in absurdity. And he said, quote, I wanted to put in bigger ideas. That's when it can get heavy-handed, though, because I wanted to put my ideas about the world in there. But when you do that through dialogue, that's terrible sometimes, a lot of times, most times. And then when you do that through setting up the situation to some realistic thing points out, the problem that people go through because of this, I don't know, that gets heavy-handed as well. So then I started having to rely on the way that I always have done things with my work, with the coup. And it's always been heightening the contradiction to the point of ridiculousness, end quote. So, you know, there's a turnoff, like a potential turnoff that will happen if you are too serious about it. Then you get kind of saccharine and, you know, it's hard to get that point across. So he's kind of putting into humor in a nice little package. But, you know, I'm curious about being an actor who probably reads through a lot of scripts. You know, is that something that might turn you off? You know, like someone tells you the synopsis of the story. And it's just like, and then there's horse people and all these other things, you know, like ridiculousness. How much do you feel comfortable going into being ridiculous as an actor?
I think that's definitely something that I explored in Freaky for the first time. But now is something I think I'm really open to, because I think Boots is right. Like, if you're dealing with these issues around like wage labor, human rights, and then in Freaky, like queerness and like womanhood in some ways, like these are things that people experience on like very intense and like intimate levels, where like if you are trying to talk about these concepts that seem so big and overarching, mm-hmm. but are actually really like personal and intimate to so many people, and you're like portraying them in a way that is like very real, it does feel like really overwhelming and intense. And I think that's definitely something that turns me off as an actor, I think, is like, you know, like getting the slave movie audition or whatever it is. It's like that, I don't know. It's like we deal with a lot of trauma already in our lives. And so I think if these concepts and these issues are not paired with like comedy or some element of fantasy or something else, then it's like, why are we even watching films in the first place? Yeah. Because we could just go outside and like look at the conditions in Baltimore City and see the same thing.
Yeah.
You
it's
know?
Like, oh yeah, it's shitty out here. Great. Something that I'm curious if it resonates with you, talking about searching out a kind of legitimacy for your art and getting kind of the gatekeepers to say that, like, yes, we think that you have value, we think that your ideas have value, and who you are has value. And that's something that I think for Boots Riley, you know, when he was talking about the very long path of getting this movie made, that he had written the first draft by the end of 2012, and then, you know, he was still just a musician to people. And he said, quote, "I joined the San Francisco Film Society's Filmmaker in Residence program. I took a bunch of the books of the script that he had published, to the actual Sundance Film Festival, handing them out on the bus and at parties, and ended up getting to have a meeting with Anne Lay from Feature Film Program. And she invited me to apply for the Screenwriters Lab. And then, once I got into that, that obviously made people take it more seriously, because before that, you're a musician with a script. People don't want to read screenwriters' scripts, so they really don't want to read musicians' scripts. So Sundance gave it some notoriety, the Screenwriters Lab, and the next year I went to the Director's Lab. And then we started to have enough buzz to have people listening to us and just started getting it to people who wanted to be a part of it." So, I mean,
wow.
The idea, it's really tough to think that someone like Boots Riley, who has been kind of on the scene in music and kind of at the pinnacle of his game for many years, then when he wants to jump into something else, people say, no, you can only be one thing. And so, again, this is one of the reasons why I brought this particular thing up, because as an artist, of course, you have multiple disciplines, as we just discussed in your bio. And I think it was really frustrating for Boots when he had actually gone to film school in San Francisco, dropped out because music seemed like the better path to explore his art. But then he couldn't get back into film. There were so many gatekeepers who said, like, you don't know what you're doing.
I think that it's really frustrating because, like, a lot of the gatekeepers in the film industry are like rich white men. And so there's like certain stories that they will accept and certain things that they will accept from artists that like don't look like them. And so I think that was another thing that was really like, really like shocking and also like important for me to see a movie like Sorry to Bother You, because mm-hmm. it like reflected these views that I had that I didn't feel like would ever be accepted by the gatekeepers in the film industry. And I was like, wow, yeah. there's somebody who is making a film about like the contradictions of capitalism, about like wage labor, about all these things that like I see in Baltimore City and experience in like my life with my family. And so that's another reason why this movie was like really impactful and like important to me. But yeah, it's like, I mean, I think it's even the same thing, like in so many different fields, like in academia, like the only reason, maybe not the only reason, but the reason that people think I'm smart is because my intelligence has been like validated or confirmed by this like rich white institution called Johns Hopkins, mm-hmm. you know? And so that's kind mm-hmm. of how like almost every like facet of society operates, where there's like these gatekeepers who are the people that are in power, that look a certain way, that are of a certain class. And then they're determining who is allowed, who is going to be accepted, who is going to be successful, who is going to be deemed valuable.
Well, it feels like a miracle when some of these stories get through in a quote-unquote mainstream way.
Yes.
Right? Because it proves that there are people who are hungry for stories like this. There are people who are hungry for Sorry to Bother You. And I can say that there are people, as we've found, there are people who are hungry for Freaky. Like, you know, there are people who are not seeing themselves in horror films, particularly queer people, particularly people of color. And to have a kind of mainstream movie that explores these ideas of identity and gender and sexuality just in a really kind of light and funny way is something that I think people are hungry for. And maybe the people at the top don't always know that there is that hunger.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a miracle, you know, when any of this stuff happens.
It honestly does feel like a miracle. I'm like, how did this one like slip through the cracks? Like,
yeah, it's
we
the
like
feeling.
Snuck
we're just
this
like,
one in.
You're like, getting go, away go, go. With something.
Yeah. literally. But yeah, that's also what I love about Freaky is that like there we talk about sexuality and gender and like even race to a certain degree in a way that is like, I think in a way that is like light and funny. And I think that like Boots was saying in his interview, when you deal with these overarching issues of like gender and sexuality and all of these things in a way that's not like built into the like dialogue or like built into like mm-hmm. very real situations, and you just like have people existing as like gay people and existing as Black people without that being like the center of like this, yeah, without that being like so central to the story or to their mm-hmm. personalities, I think that's when you really make something that is like good and makes people feel seen, because it's like I'm Black and I don't go around thinking about my Blackness at all times every day, and that's not like the central part of like my personality. When you have like characters and identities represented in situations and they're allowed to just exist in this way that is like light and can be funny and can be scary and can be whatever it is, I think that's when you really like make something that is good.
Yeah. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little more about Sorry to Bother You and also Freaky and Ghostbusters and all these other things that Celeste has done. We'll be right back.
I can remember as a child thinking it was odd that here was this can full of meat.
I'm Jesse Thorne. This week on my show Bullseye, David Letterman on shame, regret, and canned hams.
Is this the best delivery version of pork?
That's this week on Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Celeste O'Connor. We're talking about Sorry to Bother You. So one of the things I thought was very interesting was Lakeith Stanfield, when he was in this movie, he had just come off of, like, Get Out was, like, a huge thing. Atlanta was a huge thing. The thing is that when Boots Riley had cast him in this, Lakeith did not have any roles. He had not been in a film before. He had not gotten his Atlanta role. And so Boots ended up behind the scenes knowing that he needed this actor to have a name. And he was like, well, I'll help build up his name. And so he said, quote, I got him hired on several things from behind the scenes. I like whispered to make sure that his career developed so that he could be in this movie. But yeah, all these people are the folks that after figuring out, because it took getting the main character cast to figure out who would be the right people to bounce off of them. But I would say that once I got the lead character cast, then everything started being able to make sense, end quote. So that was like his secondary role was essentially like Lakeith's manager.
Oh my God.
Building up his name. And I think, you know, actors, you guys are potentially pretty knowledgeable or aware of the fact that you have to have a certain kind of name or stature to get things, right? Like, mm-hmm. But you're still kind of striving to get something that will make your name. And I feel like that must be kind of like a frustrating thing where it's just like, you know, you have the talent, you know, how you have this ability, but it's just like, when do you get to that next level? But I can't imagine, you know, like Lakeith Stanfield, like not being
right. That's so wild. I did not know that about Boots. Just being like, this guy needs to be a star by the time this movie comes out, so I'm gonna help make that happen.
Have you ever had like a director or casting director just like be like, we're gonna do this for you, like we're gonna make you? Because I feel like I wouldn't know if I'd be able to take them seriously,
right,
like, or you
yeah.
know.
Yeah, I mean, no, but that's kind of how I like got discovered in quotation marks. Like I.
Yes, Celeste, tell us how you got discovered.
Right, like, but no, it was, like, this casting director that, like, I was at this, like, talent showcase or whatever, because I was like, Mom, I want to be a singer, so I want to do this, like, little showcase thingy, and there was a casting director there, and he was like, you should try acting, and I was like, okay, sure. And so, like, he just, like, introduced me to, like, a bunch of agents and managers and was like, here, go be an actor now, seriously. And I was like, okay. But that's pretty much the extent of it. That's really funny. But, yeah, no, it's definitely a little frustrating at times being like, I know that, like, I am talented and I love acting and I love this work and I want to like be doing it more often and I want to be in these like movies that I'm seeing and whatever it is, and just kind of having to like wait for that project that is going to again help you be accepted by the gatekeepers of the film industry.
I want to talk about how Boots actually works with actors on the set. Essentially, he plans and overprepares, and we'll talk a little bit more about that, but he has understood over time the kind of need to be malleable with actors, that there has to be kind of room for experimentation or interpretation on set. He said, quote, when I'm talking to actors, I really have to get them to feel what's happening and get them to find their way into the thing and figure out what to say that allows them to use their tools in the right way. And so I think knowing how to work with actors and with everyone else on set and having a vision that, yes, it's clear and it's strong, but it's also malleable because you know that you have to be able to play with stuff that they're giving you, end quote. And we see that kind of time and again when I read through these interviews, this like this idea that directors through kind of going through the motions of prepping for their first features will realize that you have to throw so many plans out. That like the second that you get an actor in there, the second you get your DP in there, it's just like all these grand plans that you have, like you can't get them from your brain onto the screen in the same way that you thought. And it maybe shouldn't be that way, that it should be a collaboration. But I think that there's so much power when you're an actor, as long as your director is allowing you to have that power.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I definitely think that like all the directors that I've worked with have, first of all, obviously been amazing, but have really like given me and the other actors space to like try different things and to understand like these scenes and these emotions in the way that like makes sense to us and that like can then translate effectively. I think like going from working with Tyresha, who is like a young Black woman, and like kind of understanding each other in that way and being able to like communicate to each other in that way. That was like really, really comforting. And I think that, you know, made me feel like I had some room to explore, and try different things. And then going from Stella, which was like small indie, to like being on the set of Ghostbusters, which was like a whole different experience and a whole different process, was like such a learning experience, because like even though I couldn't necessarily connect with Jason on the level of like, you know, he is a white man, he still like gave us all so much space to like explore creatively, to improvise. He would ask us about like, oh, do you think that the character would say this line, or do you think there's another way that you could say this that would feel, you know, more comfortable to you? So, and then that also was the case with Chris, where like I just felt like I've been so lucky to work with directors who are so like open with me and also like vulnerable in a way that they like will let me like come onto this project that they have written and that is like their baby, and then to bring me on board and allow me to explore and improvise and try different things, I think is like really beautiful, because like your art is so personal, and so you have to be so vulnerable to like let another person in to be a part of it, and especially to like improvise within it.
That's I mean, like there's a lot of things that we could get into with what you just said, but part of that is that I'm going to tell you the fact that Lakeith Stanfield does not like being off book, and will prolong being off book until the absolute last second of shooting, which I found like intriguing and also fucking nerve-wracking, but I mean, he's got a reason for it. As Boots Riley said, he said, quote, he was very in tune with the emotional place that the character needed to be, but I was like, when are you going to get off book? And he said, I usually don't do that until a couple of days or a day or so before the scene. That's the kind of direction that worries me, though. But what it really does for him is make the emotions primary and the line secondary to that. You feel him figuring out what to say right there, and it works so well. And yet there's an improvisational urge in me, too. Sometimes I just let the camera sit on the actor for a while without yelling cut, and 90% of that was useless. But the 10% that was were things that were poignant things in the movie, like when he gets the promotion and goes, yeah, and he looks over and we see the conflict in his face, end quote. So I like the idea that Lakeith's idea of kind of trusting himself and his instincts to like find the emotions in the moment and to not kind of over rehearse them, also had an influence on Boots Riley's decisions on, you know, how to be a little bit more improvisational and kind of loose in the moment. You're a studious person. Are you an off book person?
I'm a studious person, and I think that being in school has actually really helped me with memorization for this job. But mm-hmm. I Definitely. I definitely like identify with what Lakeitha's saying in that interview. I don't really like memorize things until like a day or two before, because I definitely agree. I think that like for me, what works is really what Lakeitha's saying, is like to focus on what is like the emotional place that the character is in this moment, so that like once you add the lines on top of that, like, I don't know, I find that most directors I work with or haven't been as like married to the exact words that are in the scene and are more committed to like conveying whatever emotion it needs that needs to be conveyed. So I definitely think that that's the way I do things. I really like to like make like an emotional map when I like get a script, is to like be like, where does Nyla start out, and at this point in the story, like what is her emotion, and how, and like what is the, to get from this emotion to the next one, what is that transition like? So I definitely kind of translate the words on the script into emotions, and sometimes I like associate those emotions with like songs and like add a playlist. So I definitely agree with Lakeith that like for me, I feel like my process is so much more related to the emotions I need to convey, and how I can convey those emotions, and what it'll take from my own personal experiences to get there. And that's where I think that music really comes in, is like I definitely associate music with strong and complicated emotions, and so that's kind of how I do things. And then I'll be like and then I'll be like looking at the sides, like in the hair and makeup trailer.
You're like, oh no, what is this? Oh, I'm okay. Like,
oh, okay, let me write that down.
We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a lot more Sorry to Bother You and Freaky and Ghostbusters and Cello and Spades and all that. We'll be right back.
Congratulations. You've won a ticket to attend an exclusive opportunity in a relaxing environment with two lovers.
Wow. Well, this sounds like a sort of proposition of sorts, but really it's an ad for our podcast. Wonderful. It's a show we do here on Maximum Fun, where we talk about things that we like and things that we're into.
I'm Rachel McElroy, and you just heard Griffin McElroy, and we are excited for you to join us as we talk about movies and music and books.
Things like sneezing or the idea of rain.
Can you get news or information you can use?
Absolutely,
so.
You cannot, because we're here to talk to you about pumpernickel bread.
You can find new episodes on Wednesdays.
So catch the wave!
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm Amber Wolf, and I'm joined today by Celeste O'Connor, and we're talking Sorry to Bother You. Tessa Thompson, this was a little bit more of a risk for her, I think, in her career, because she had already been, you know, kind of launched in these ways. You know, she was already working on Thor and some things that would kind of change her image potentially. And for her, though, I think she was very interested in the fact that it was a risk. Like, that was actually the drawing point for her, was just like, okay, at least I can do something different. You know, at least it's not always just going to be Marvel. And she said, quote, "I think anytime I play a part, it's about either expanding parts of myself or making certain parts of myself smaller, trying to diminish them, trying to meet somewhere in between where this character lies. So either it's about making myself more bold or fearless or obnoxious than I already am, or it's about making myself shyer. But it all starts with me, so of course it's easier when you have the baseline. There were other things that were outside of me about her, like doing her performance art piece. That felt really challenging. First, it was written to be nude, and I was like, oh Lord, please no. Then, the actual costume was literally just like three leather gloves. So to get up on stage in front of a group of people with not that much clothing on, And to do something that makes you look, frankly, very silly was really vulnerable. But I really like that. I like finding something in a part. I really only like to take parts that scare me a little bit, end quote.
Yes. I feel that so much. Oh my God. I think that was like, that was definitely one of the factors that like drew me so much to Freaky too, is that like I was reading the script and I was like, I have never done anything like this before. And I was reading it. I was reading through like the fight scenes and I was like, can I even do this? Like, mm-hmm. I literally have like never tried this. I had never done anything like it before or been a part of any project that was like it at all. And so that was something, that was definitely something that drew me to it. And I really feel like that's a good way for me to tell if I should do something or not, is if it scares me. And so that's why I was like, all right, gotta dive headfirst into this like fight sequence.
Yeah. I mean, I think yeah. You get to like, one of you guys gets to hit someone with a cast iron pan, if I remember correctly.
Oh my God. Yeah, that is also a story. We were like,
it is.
This was like our like 13, hour like 14 of filming this fight scene. And we were like at the end part where I have to go and like hit Misha over the head with this pan, and it's a prop pan, but I go to hit Misha and they come up from the floor with like an actual scratch on their forehead and like blood dripping down their face. And I was like, oh my God, like I actually hit them in the head with this like prop pan. I was like, okay, first of all, why? I thought this was foam, but
were they mad? Like
they were a little not too happy, but now it's a funny joke between us.
Okay, that's good. Yeah, did you ever, I mean, like you're also hitting a giant man with Vince Vaughn, like this is a
Yeah, it was actually really fun though. It was like I was really scared. I was scared to do the kitchen fight scene, the ending fight scene, and then the scream, like the frame that they have put in like every trailer of like just my face so tight on just my face screaming. I was like, oh my God, that's terrifying, especially because Vince is not even in front of me. I'm like screaming at this like little tape on this like X, this tape on like the top of the camera box. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was actually the days of those scenes that were like the most challenging and the most fun for me. Cause it ended up being like, it ended up being so fun because I was with Misha, who is now like one of my really close friends, and Vince, who is like so fun and like lively and exciting on set. And so it ended up being moments of very important moments of growth in like my like personal work and also just like as a person in general.
That's really sweet. I mean, Freaky is a horror comedy, and it's just like there's a lot of moments of unexpected tenderness.
Yeah.
So I can see how that would be like a kind of growth period for someone. But I wanted to kind of end on a note that Tessa Thompson had said, which struck me, and I thought that maybe you would also find this as well. She said, quote, "I've always wanted to make a film that hung out in the space of magical realism. So many of the films that I love, that I grew up watching over and over again as I really decided that I wanted to work in film, used magical realism. But they don't have black and brown faces in them. We just seem to be excluded from those narratives. And for that reason, I just always assumed I would never get to make a film like that. And so when this thing came along, I was just like, finally," end quote. And,
yes.
You know, I think she's expressing probably something that, you know, most of the cast and crew were thinking. It's just like, again, all the stuff that we're talking about, this kind of like low budget, kind of like having to be a community of filmmakers, you're all pulling together because you don't see this represented on screen in the way that it is.
Yeah, exactly. I think that like so often like sci-fi and fantasy and like magical realism are like genres that I think have always been reserved for white people, because when you put like black actors and especially black women into spaces, it then becomes like so many of these films then become about this person's blackness or their struggles. And we have so many movies that are like trauma porn about like growing up in inner cities or slave movies. And I think that...
Yeah, this is like the third time you said slave movies. I'm like, how many slave scripts is Celeste getting? Because like, I'm worried about you.
Literally. But it's like, I think so many of these movies are like made, so many of these movies that include black actors are made for the white gaze. And that's really why like... And that's really why we only see black people in these movies about like poverty and traumas, because I think that a lot of the times white people don't see black people in ways that are outside of our like trauma. And so something that is really like powerful and important to see is like, again, Boots Riley being like, there's not space for me right now. The gatekeepers are not letting me in. So I'm going to create the space to make these stories that have magic and sci-fi and fantasy in it, because black people want that too. We all want that. And I think that's something
is that going to change? Like, because I mean, if you're talking about both Freaky and Ghostbusters, those are genre properties. And, you know, Stella and the Spades, though, it is drama. You know, Tyrese was very inspired by Brick and the kind of noirness of that. So it's just like, it's teetering on that edge of genre as well. Right. So, I mean, is that something that's going to drive the projects that you choose from now on? Is just like, you would like to see people who look like you in these spaces, or?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think that the way, like we were talking about before, the way I really want to approach projects is whatever is scary and new and seems really challenging to me in the moment is something that I want to do, because I always want the opportunity to grow and learn something new, especially about myself and in terms of like my career and stuff. But I think that it would be awesome to be in more like sci-fi, fantasy, like magical movies, because yeah, we actually don't see black people in these genres. And there are so many black kids that would love to see a like superhero movie or a like sci-fi Star Trek or whatever it is with people that look like them in it.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about Sorry to Bother You and also Freaky.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. This was such a fun conversation.
And you can see Celeste in Freaky, which is in select theaters right now. If you would like to tell us what you think of the show, you can tweet at us at SwitchbladePod or email us at SwitchbladeSisters@MaximumFun.org. And please check out our Facebook group too. That's facebook.com/groups/SwitchbladeSisters. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher. And this is a production of MaximumFun.org.
Fuck you, pay me.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.